Meeting will come to order. We'll just give you 30 seconds to find spots. We have a very full agenda today, so we're taking advantage of every minute. And we have today five professors from the University of Minnesota. You'll hear why one of them is missing from our first speaker. University of Minnesota scientists who will provide an update on current science and how it can be the basis for making solid investment decisions. And this is a joint committee of three committees that make those kinds of investment decisions: capital investment, natural resources, and legacy. But before we get into that subject, I will recognize Representative Wagenius for the purpose of making a very important introduction.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. I am thrilled that we have with us today members and officers of the FFA. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here, and we're going to hear from your officers in just a moment. But first, I would like to tell you this is a particularly good day to have you here, because we all recognize that we have one of the best universities in the United States, and we have professors from the university here today to talk to us. And I suspect some of you will go to the university and have some of these professors as your own. With that, I would like to welcome your folks, Marjorie Schlepper, who is Vice President, and Shauna Conrad, who is President. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you for having us this morning. My name is Shauna Conrad. I'm from the Goodhue FFA chapter and currently serving as a Minnesota FFA State President this year. Among you, there are 30 other blue jackets in this room, but only a few of the 9,500 plus FFA members that we have in the state of Minnesota. And there's 500,000 across the nation, and each one of those jackets has a very different story to tell. I didn't grow up living on a farm. I grew up living in town, and my first connection to agriculture came when I joined the FFA as a seventh grader in high school. And ever since then, I've slowly grown a passion for agriculture and am now studying to become an agricultural educator. So there are many different stories in this room, and I know that we would be thrilled to share with you maybe later today. Otherwise, we're going to be back on February 21st for FFA Day at the Capitol.
I'm Marjorie Schlepper from the Uppsala FFA chapter, way up by St. Cloud. Some of you know where that's at. I'm serving as the state vice president, as was mentioned earlier. My story, as Shauna said, is a little different. I grew up on a small hobby farm in rural Minnesota. We had dogs, cats, and horses. But my real connection to agriculture came through agricultural education. In seventh grade, when I enrolled in my first ag ed class, that's where I finally got it. I realized why everything we were learning in the core subjects mattered, why they mattered to me now, and why they would matter to me later on in my career. Agricultural education works very closely with FFA to help prepare students for great careers and to be great citizens, not only in our state, but in our country as a whole. I just wanted to remind you, as Shauna said earlier, that if we don't get a chance to chat today, FFA members will be back, FFA members from all across the state, February 21st for FFA Day at the Capitol.
Our mission statement is to positively influence the lives of students by developing their potential for three things: premier leadership, personal growth, and career success. And FFA is doing that today through agriculture education. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for this opportunity to be here this morning. Thank you once again, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here. I have to say, members and FFA members, I'm from another era. I was born and raised on a farm, and at the time that I was in high school, all of the FFA members were male. So to have a mixed group here. Now, of course, so we couldn't be in the FFA, but I was the FFA sweetheart. It was a very different time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And so if we could have our first two speakers, we are members, not going to spend any time in introductions. You have in your packets the bios of all of our speakers this morning. And we have a slight change in order. We're going to begin with Dr. Thorleifson, who will explain why our first speaker isn't here. So welcome to the committee, and as you speak, please identify yourself for the record.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair, chairs of the respective committees, members of the committee. My name is Harvey Thorleifson. I'm a University of Minnesota professor and director of the Minnesota Geological Survey. We appreciate this opportunity to respond to your request for an update on current science and how it can be the basis for making solid investment decisions. We were pleased that our presentation has been coordinated by Dr. John Foley, director of the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment. However, as you have noted, John is absent. Sadly, John is ill, hopefully not for long, but I will briefly provide an overview of John's presentation, if that's all right. So John, in his presentation, has stressed the importance of recent global trends. He has stressed population growth as a major factor, growth of technology and of our economy. And he has stressed in his presentation that we are dealing with accelerating change. Between 1960 and 2010, John notes that population, global population has doubled, our economy has increased sevenfold, food consumption has increased threefold, water use threefold, fossil fuel use has increased fourfold. And he has stressed that more there have been more changes in the last 50 years than all previous generations combined. He therefore stresses that we're at an inflection point in history with major environmental changes, major environmental challenges ahead. He has mentioned major pressures on agriculture with a need to double production by the year 2050, significant impacts on land, water, and climate. He has mentioned major pressures on water with demands for water increasing dramatically and water quantity and quality declining concurrently. He has stressed major pressures on climate with climate patterns shifting globally and in emissions increasing globally while currently lowering in the U.S. And he has stressed that the purpose of his presentation has been to present a global context for our focus today on recent trends in Minnesota. So with that brief overview of some of the comments that John Foley was planning to make, we can then transition to the series of presentations that you mentioned, Madam Chair, starting with Dr. Mark Seeley discussing climate. Dr. Peter Reich will follow, speaking on forests. I will then speak on water. Dr. Bonnie Keeler will speak on landscapes. And Dr. Nick Jordan will speak on agriculture. So I will shift to those presentations, and we'll go.
And members, so that we get the content of all the speakers, if you would just note your questions, and then we'll save questions until the end. All the speakers will stay here till the end, and so we'll have a question and answer period at the end of the presentations to make sure that we give sufficient time for everyone. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Mark Seeley. I'm Extension Climatologist at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. My purpose fundamentally is to talk about what is happening in our own backyard. I work closely with the National Weather Service and the Minnesota State Climatology Office in terms of ingesting all of the many volunteer weather observations we have in this state, which, by the way, go back to 1807, pre-statehood days. In that regard, I would like to salute the FFA today as for their many decades of service as volunteer weather observers in our state observation network. They've served us very well, generation after generation. I'm going to talk about the signals of climate change in the data in our state, and I'm going to also allude to a few of the consequences. I apologize, some of the slides I will go through rather rapidly, but they are available on our website and also in your packet of materials. fundamentally, and a very important premise for all of us to understand, is how we as human beings perceive climate behavior. Across the centuries of climate science investigations, there's four dominant perceptions of climate behavior. This graphic, which is an illustration of a famous paper by Professor Stan Chagnon in Illinois, is an illustration of the graphical depictions of those perceptions. The stationary view is simply one that states if we observe the climate at a point on Earth year after year, decade after decade, we will be able to describe the central tendencies of that attribute, such as the central horizontal line or mean value, be it annual precipitation or mean annual temperature or something like that. We will be able to describe its annual cycle and its extremes. And the premise being that the stationary perception is that after a certain number of decades, we will have captured all the knowledge we need for that point on Earth. That's a founding father's perception. You'll recall that in the writings of Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and others, this was how they perceived climate behavior. Second perception is a cyclical one, which I'm going to skip over because it has little relevance in Minnesota. However, in equatorial landscapes, it's very valid in that the climate attributes do behave in a cyclical pattern and, in fact, are used by government weather services in those geographic locations. The third perception is a modification of the stationary one, which is called the variability perception of climate behavior, and that is simply that climate variability, year-to-year variation in climate attributes, will wax and wane across time. We have ample evidence in Minnesota's history that we did go through periods where it was highly amplified, one year distinctly different from another, from another, from another, and then other sequences of years when it seemed like we were stuck in a rut and the climate was behaving the same way year after year after year. Fundamentally, it's perceptions 1 and 3 that I would argue and that I argue in my book, which is Minnesota's Weather History, the Minnesota Weather Almanac, that our infrastructure and our quality of life in the state we live in is fundamentally based on perceptions 1 and 3, the stationary and variability perceptions of climate behavior. We have adjusted our freshwater supply system, our public health infrastructure, our roads and highways, our architecture, our agriculture, any number of the other pieces of our infrastructure that prop up our quality of life have been adjusted to these perceptions of climate behavior over the years. Now, unfortunately, we are in climate number 4, which in the bottom graphic is the trend shift view of climate. That is, the climate now is behaving outside the historical realm that we have observed for over 150 years. It's not only behaving outside the historical realm, but the frequency shifts in some of the extremes are occurring at rates that we have not observed in our climate history. There are three attributes of our climate that are changing. Temperature is changing, skewed to the winter season and skewed to the overnight minimum. Water vapor. We are seeing influxes and higher frequency of water vapor in our state's environment, and it's having some consequences. And lastly, amplified moisture variability with a greater contribution from thunderstorm precipitation. The upward trend in mean annual temperature for the state of Minnesota in aggregate from our 252 long-term weather observation sites shows that in recent decades, the slope of the line upward is more steep than the long-term slope. That is, it's accelerating. We would also note on the far right end of the graphic that many of our warmest years in history have occurred in recent decades, well above the historic 90th percentile. The seasonality distribution of that temperature change is skewed toward the winter season, as you can see in the upper left graphic. For both persistence and amplitude, the winter season, the season of December, January, and February, has a more pronounced upward temperature signal than the other seasons of the year, albeit the other seasons do show a positive upward slope in the temperature. The new normals, which were released to the public last year, show shifts in the baseline averages location by location around our state. An example from St. Cloud here shows the magnitude of change. These are not the actual normals. These are the changes in the temperature normals, month by month. You'll see the minimum change is entirely positive in St. Cloud, for example. The maximum is slightly mixed in that the month of May was a negative change, but the overall mean change is dominantly positive. This is true for all locations in the state of Minnesota. The other piece I would like you to observe is that the minimum temperature change in the month of January was a plus 3. That is a remarkable magnitude of change for only one decade additional data. That designates a more rapid pace of change. The water water vapor signal in our state is depicted here in these graphics that show an upward slope in the occurrence of 70 degree dew points, which in the climate sciences we designate as a tropical air mass. This is an air mass more typical of Cancun, Mexico than Minnesota. Nevertheless, we see the frequency with which this type of air mass visits Minnesota is increasing in frequency both here in the Twin Cities and up at Voyageurs National Park along the Canadian border. The consequence of these high water vapor air masses is that the National Weather Service is more frequently having to issue heat advisories. The combination of temperature and water vapor in the atmosphere achieves or exceeds the 105 degree heat index, which serves as a trigger for the National Weather Service to issue a heat advisory or an excessive heat warning to the public. And you'll see many recent years have seen, in fact, the heat index on July 19th of 2011 was 134 degrees at Moorhead, Minnesota. So if you were an alien spacecraft observing planet Earth at 4 p.m. on July 19, 2011, the hottest point on planet Earth would have been Moorhead, Minnesota, what we call a singularity in our climate data. The heat waves have, in recent years, been all dew point driven. They have not been, as they were in earlier Minnesota history, driven by ambient temperatures of 110 or 112, but they've been driven by high dew points. Lastly, the amplified precipitation signal is depicted here in the aggregate of annual precipitation in the state of Minnesota, once again clustered on the far right side of this graphic, are all the years where we exceeded the 75th percentile in terms of the population of the data, with the all-time wettest year in Minnesota history being the year of 2010. Our normals have shifted upward in average annual precipitation, in some cases by 20 to 30% over what they once were. And more importantly, as designated by many climate scientists, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, all the geographic regions on the world map in the lower illustration there that have a blue plus sign have all seen a higher fraction of their annual precipitation come from thunderstorms. The recurrence intervals for intense thunderstorm precipitation have all increased in frequency, and our PCA, Department of Agriculture, and DNR and others all await the new hydrologic manual that's due out later this year for Minnesota to show an increased frequency in recurrence of intense precipitation. We've had 3 1,000-year floods in southern Minnesota since the year 2004 as an illustration of that. We also have seen drought. Thunderstorms infer high spatial or geographic distribution and disparity. We have had severe to extreme drought surface somewhere on the Minnesota landscape every summer since 2007. So for 8 consecutive years, somewhere in Minnesota has had to cope with severe to extreme drought. Consequences, and I apologize, this cannot be a comprehensive list, but consequences play out in a variety of ways in the changes in these climate attributes. We do have longer growing seasons. We have had changes in our plant hardiness zones. We see shorter duration. Our lakes and soils are frozen in the wintertime. We have to defer fall nitrogen applications on our agricultural soils to later and later dates on the calendar because they don't cool off as rapidly. We have biological organisms surviving Minnesota's winter more frequently than in former days when our temperatures inflicted a high mortality. We have changes in our fisheries management. I won't go through all the rest of the list, but there's a variety of ways this plays out on our infrastructure and our management of our natural resources and our agricultural enterprises. So these are already having consequence. We need to pay attention to these. Our predecessors in Minnesota have done so, and we need to do likewise. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. I'm glad we have the takeaway. That was a lot of information in a short amount of time, and we'll perhaps have questions later. And you will note the flow of these presentations, that the last speaker is very much connected to the content that you just heard. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to chat with you today. I'm Peter Reich from the Department of Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota, and I'm glad to have the chance to talk to you about challenges facing Minnesota's forests in the coming decades. I'd like to remind us that the services that forests play, fiber, climate regulation, recreation, resources, habitat for biodiversity, and carbon sequestration, so these are very important to us. Although the words you'll hear today are mine, what I have to say is very consistent with a consensus report from an assessment advisory panel organized by the Minnesota Forest Resources Council earlier this year that included members from environmental groups, forest industry, academia, and various state and federal agencies. A couple background pieces. We should remember we all live, most of us that is, in villages, towns, or cities surrounded by trees, so our urban forests are very important to us. More broadly, our forests are distributed towards the northeastern part of the state, increasingly so as you go towards the Arrowhead, but more than half of the area in the state has important parts of the landscape that are forested. It's also important to think about how old our forests are. If all the forests were 10 years old or 200 years old, we would lack a lot of diversity in a variety of ways that would be challenging for us. As it turns out, today, our forests are relatively even-aged, or all-aged, meaning we have roughly, all-aged, not even-aged. We have about the same fraction of our forests that are 10 years old, 30 years old, 50 years old, 70, 90 years old. Now, depending where on the spectrum from the environment to industry you fall, some might like the forests a bit older, some a bit younger. My perspective is actually we're not in a bad place at all with respect to the mix of forest ages we have on our landscape. What about the harvesting of our forest? Just to remind us, we harvest about 134,000 acres in 2008, which was down considerably from 12 years earlier. And that amounts to about just a little bit less than 1% of our forests are harvested annually. Well, the challenges that we're facing in the next coming decades. The first one is climate change, which you just heard a lot about from Mark Seeley. Talk about forest health threats, forest fragmentation and parcelization, and changes in biodiversity and wildlife habitat. With respect to climate change, we know that climate change will affect the biodiversity structure and function of our forest. What we don't know is exactly how. So what will happen to the makeup of species that are in our forests? How healthy will these trees be? How well will they grow? We don't actually know, but we do expect there to be significant problems in some places. As was pointed out in an article in the front page of the Star Tribune today from a U.S. Global Climate Change report that talked about a significant birch declines in the U.S. Midwest, including Minnesota. Because of changes in forests, watershed, water flow, and water quality will be impacted. And, of course, forest-dependent human communities and economies will be impacted by any change in the forest. So it's not just trees that are out there being affected, but the people who depend on those trees. Forest health threats, we think about these a lot in terms of how forests are influenced by fire, windstorms, insects, other event kind of disturbances. These have always been part of our landscape. Climate change just makes them worse because with climate change we have more fires, more windstorms, more insect pests, and more diseases. So the challenge we face in managing these forests is how do we sustain diversity and ecosystem function in the face of invasives, pests, and climate change? And although I won't mention them much otherwise, invasive plants such as buckthorn may be a real problem statewide in limiting regeneration of our forests to valuable tree species. Forest fragmentation, parcelization, and development is another issue that's unrelated to climate change. Although it slowed down during the Great Recession, we're building more and more second homes, retirement homes, and everyday homes out as far as we can get to the end of the dirt road out in the woods, because we like it there. And that creates problems, as it does throughout the United States, in the so-called urban-wildland interface, because the needs of the people who live there for things such as keeping their houses from burning aren't necessarily in sync with the needs of the forests, which actually burn regularly as part of their natural ecology. And so the way in which parcelization and fragmentation will impact our forests is a big deal in the rural areas. In the urban areas, our urban forests are important. And we've already lost a tree cover. According to Gary Johnson, the urban forester at the U, tree cover in our towns and cities is less than 25%. Optimal is more than 40% to maximize benefits for stormwater regulation and for shading and cooling in the summer. And those are real dollars that go along with those trees in the urban areas. The last major issue I want to talk about is biodiversity and wildlife habitat, where changes in forests and changes in associated issues such as climate change and disturbance pose risks to a wide array of diversity. Forests are not just trees, they include all the other plants and wildlife. Moose are a poster child for this particular risk from climate change. Moose are declining in the state. It's hard to see any way in which moose will retain viable populations well into the future. I'm sure you'll hear about that sometime in the next month or two from some other speakers. So the challenge to us as managers is, what management strategies can we take that will mitigate negative changes or promote adaptation and resilience in a forest for wildlife and biodiversity? I like to use this photo because it pulls together a lot of what I just talked about in the last few slides. I use our iconic Arrowhead region with lakes and pristine-looking forests. And we know those forests are going to change with climate change. The question marks, though, show that we don't know which direction they're going to change. Will they move down to the bottom left there if the climate becomes similar to what was conducive to savannas in the pre-settlement area, where savannas covered maybe almost a third of our forested areas in the state? Or if it gets warmer and drier, will we have the typical oak maple forests that now inhabit much of northern Wisconsin, which is shown in the bottom right? Or what if the current forests decline in the far north, but the oaks and maples can't move fast enough up there to replace them? Will we end up with some kind of scrubland or shrubland, as shown in the upper right, that is not valuable from either an ecological or economic perspective, and have to live with that and manage that for decades? Because we don't know exactly how climate's changing, nor exactly how forests will respond to climate change, it's impossible to say which of these arrows and pathways is the one that our forests will actually see, but we can be fairly assured that we're not going to stay the same. And so uncertainty is a challenge as well. How do you manage a forest in the face of considerable uncertainty? Just a couple pictures to demonstrate some of these. As Mark Seely pointed out, climate change is extremes. It's not just being a little warmer on average. We're going to have more heat waves, more floods, more droughts. There'll be an increasing frequency of severe events, thunderstorms, tornadoes, wildfires that all have direct impacts on our forests. Just a couple pictures. This is a picture before and after on the left of the July 4th, 1999 blowdown up in the Arrowhead. So windstorms can wreak enormous havoc in a hurry. Both native and invasive insects can also cause forest change. We haven't seen it yet, but the emerald ash borer will be here soon in the forested part of the state and basically kill almost all our ash. But other insects are also likely to cause outbreaks. An example is the mountain pine beetle in British Columbia. Previously, it was a benign insect, didn't cause much damage, but because winters are warmer and the growing season's longer, the populations explosively grow, and they cause massive damage. They killed more than 40 million acres in British Columbia. It's now jumped from lodgepole pine to jack pine, and it's making its way east. We don't know when it would get to Minnesota, but it probably will eventually. So mountain pine beetle, emerald ash borer, there are many other insects that are probably going to have important effects on our forests in a warmer world. And fire. We all know fire is important. Fire was part of our heritage in these fire-adapted northern forests. Just like with Goldilocks in the Three Bears, we need fire to be just right. If we have too much fire or too little fire, this is going to cause problems for people and the fire and the forest. And because we don't control the climate directly in an easily tunable way that influences fires, we're going to get fire regimes that we don't necessarily want, and so we have to be prepared for those. So in conclusion, for our northern pine, spruce, and aspen forest, these are projected to do poorly with climate change, just as we saw in the paper today about birch. And the risk of forest decline is real due to the collapse of these boreal species that, just like the moose, are not necessarily suited for increasing warmer temperatures and episodic droughts. Now, to the south of them, we have oaks and maples. Those will expand north, but natural migration is not likely to keep pace with climate change, and many of these species don't grow well on the rocky, poor soils further north. In addition, these forests might become stressed in their current range due to droughts, insects, and the like associated with climate change. So what strategy do we have? Well, one thing we can do is encourage more climate-robust species, either local ones or from neighboring systems. And that's something new to think about, importing something from Iowa, maybe, to help us out. That's not something we like to do in Minnesota. But this may be necessary to maintain healthy forests. However, this is not enough. And here, this is my own words, not the consensus view of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. For me, the question at this pivotal moment is, how much do we truly care about Minnesota's forests and ecosystems? Do we sit and watch as they decline right before our very eyes, decade by decade? Or do we, as caring and responsible Minnesotans, take action to cut our greenhouse gas emissions? The reason I say this is that climate change adaptation, not just for forests, but I would argue for all aspects of society, is nothing more than a Band-Aid. Without stopping climate change, we're in trouble. So stopping climate change is the only real solution we have. I think it's time to work together on this, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. And now we'll move on to water, I think, right, Dr. Thorleifson?
Well, again, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I want to say to the respective chairs and members of the committee that we appreciate this opportunity. Again, my name is Harvey Thorleifson. I'm the University of Minnesota professor and Minnesota Geological Survey director, and I'm pleased to have this opportunity to discuss key issues facing freshwater resources in Minnesota. At the outset, I want to stress that our surface water resources in lakes and streams are well known with respect to their extent, their capacity, and their vulnerability. In those surface water resources, a defining characteristic is that we are a headwaters state. So virtually all of our water comes from rain and snow rather than from the flow of rivers entering the state. We thus have control of our resources, although we have responsibilities to downstream neighbors with respect to the water quality and quantity that we export. And without a supply from upstream, we are particularly vulnerable to drought. Now, in contrast to our knowledge of surface water, far less well known are the groundwater resources that supply 75% of our drinking water and 90% of our agricultural irrigation water. The water that we use so extensively from groundwater is obtained from wells that are installed in aquifers of greatly varying capacity, vulnerability, geology, and depth. This groundwater is replenished gradually by precipitation. Much of it is used by plants, and an important role of groundwater in our landscape is the role of groundwater systems in discharging to springs so that stream flow is sustained and lakes and wetlands are sustained even during drought. Water plays so many roles in our lives. Plentiful water of high quality is essential for our economy. Drinking water quality is a key determinant of public health. Drought and flooding are among the greatest risks we face, and water hosts landscape elements and ecosystems that play crucial roles in our lives while being under threat from invasive species. It therefore is essential for all of our activities to be guided by the best possible peer-reviewed research, and we see some examples of that peer-reviewed research recently produced by the University of Minnesota, because this is the understanding that we need to guide all of our activities. And this certainly is happening. Research is very active. It's being done as required, but at the same time, there remain many great unknowns and unanticipated discoveries that need to be solved by the local and international research communities to support our progress toward our objectives. Now, while stressing the essential role of conceptual research, I also want to stress that in terms of the science that we need to deal with water-related issues and to pursue our objectives, that research needs to be coordinated with mapping, which is spatial, and monitoring, which is temporal. Together, this research on a conceptual basis, the spatial mapping and temporal monitoring facilitates modeling, which is an essential component of management. This is the spectrum that we require. There will always be a need for ongoing research on concepts, and it is good that we have accelerated the concurrent mapping and monitoring that is needed both to support the research and to facilitate the required modeling and management. Now, the research needs to be reconciled. The research mapping and monitoring needs to be reconciled, however, with activities such as consultations and priority setting for it to result in management actions that will allow the people of Minnesota to fulfill our objectives. And I think it's fair to say that this activity has been well conducted, as is indicated by recent reports that have focused our priorities on what we need to do and what our options are to implement greater recognition of issues and the science that we need to deal with those issues. A recurring theme in these reports, however, with which I agree, is the urgent need to do better understand our groundwater. It has been recognized that in many ways we don't know the capacity nor the vulnerability of our groundwater systems. So our management actions with respect to groundwater are in part based on unknowns. It therefore is good that work on obtaining a better understanding of our groundwater has accelerated, and there is consensus that continued acceleration is needed if we are to adequately grasp what we need to do to wisely use and protect our groundwater. So having reviewed that background, I now want to focus on an overview of the point I was asked to address, which is what are the issues that are facing freshwater resources in the state of Minnesota. And I believe those issues were very well summarized in the 2011 Sustainability Framework, which was commissioned by the 2009 legislature and authored by a team led by the U Water Resources Center under the coordination of Professor Deb Swackhammer. The issues that were identified along with appropriate strategies and performance measures were, number one, the need for a sustainable and clean water supply, excess nutrients and other conventional pollutants, contaminants of emerging concerns such as pharmaceuticals, the impact of land use and climate change on water, the health of aquatic ecosystems, the linkage of water and energy issues such as the energy needed to pump and treat water and wastewater, water pricing and valuation, public water infrastructure needs, citizen engagement and education, as well as governance and institutions. It's a broad array of intertwined issues, and it's pleasing that there is excellent progress underway on the activity that's required to deal with these issues. But of course, what we're focusing on today is much remains to be done. And I'll finish with two examples from that list. First, I want to mention the threat posed by aquatic invasive species. It's an example of a rapidly emerging issue. These species, for example, relate to ballast water in the Great Lakes or migration of species, for example, upstream in the Mississippi. As you know, better knowledge and swift action are required to curb their spread and to minimize their harmful effects. And finally, with respect to the science agenda that has been so well defined that, and that we need to continue to accelerate with respect to groundwater, increased monitoring is needed, increased research is needed, and I would like to focus on the County Geologic Atlas program. We're focusing our efforts on the mapping that is needed. This is the program coordinated by the Minnesota Geological Survey and the DNR. And the reason why there is a focus on this program is because there has been, over the past decade or so, so much rapid progress in science, in technology, and data availability. And because of that progress, coincident with the increased need to better manage groundwater, we now have an opportunity to significantly improve our understanding of groundwater, in part through the production of atlases. These county geologic atlases are multi-layered databases and maps that provide information needed to facilitate sustainable management of groundwater resources. It is good that we have made progress on accelerating new atlases, on required atlas updates, as well as on statewide databases such that there is better information in every county throughout the state so that we can better protect our groundwater. So in closing, I want to again indicate my appreciation for this opportunity to discuss key issues facing freshwater resources in Minnesota, and I look forward to discussion. Thanks again.
Thank you, and we are joined now by Dr. Keeler, and we're still on water, I think.
That's right. All right, Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'm Bonnie Keeler. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota, where I work at the Institute on the Environment with Dr. John Foley. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the studies that were mentioned in the previous talk, where we've actually looked at different allocation and investment strategies in Minnesota land use and how that affects water quality and other environmental benefits. So this is about my own research as well as research of colleagues of mine that work at the U of M, at the Institute on the Environment and the Applied Economics Program. So the framework that I'm going to talk about really relates to linking actions or decisions that we're making about how we manage our land resources. So whether it's changes in development patterns, changes in agricultural management practices or forestry practices, or decisions about how we make restoration or conservation decisions in the state. And all of those decisions have a suite of consequences for water resources, whether we're talking about surface water, our streams, lakes, rivers, groundwater resources, changing both the amount and quantity of water in those resources as well as the quality. And that those changes in quantity and quality of water resources have a variety of impacts on Minnesotans. So you can think about whether you're a resort owner in northern Minnesota and you're interested in your tourism, the tourism revenue provided by water resources, recreational activities, hunting and wildlife recreation, treatment costs that are incurred by taxpayers in towns and cities, and then events such as flooding or droughts and the impacts that those changes have on resources in Minnesota as well as our own human well-being. So the framework that my research looks at is really trying to link the decisions we make on the landscape about how we manage our land and our water resources together and how those affect particular groups of Minnesotans and the economic values associated with those impacts. So I'm going to talk about a couple of recent studies that we've looked at this issue. So we did a report a couple of years ago looking at the return on investment in Minnesota's natural capital. We worked with DNR to obtain about 20 years of data on public land acquisitions in the state, and then looked at how the investment in conservation paid off in terms of environmental benefits to Minnesotans. So both the agricultural resources produced on those lands, timber resources, along with other benefits like changes in water quality, how that affects people, carbon sequestration, and recreational benefits, among other things. And basically what we found from this study was strong evidence that conservation was a good investment in Minnesota, that investing in land conservation resulted in positive net return to the landscape from these variety of environmental benefits. So in order to do the study, basically we looked at the landscape of Minnesota right now, which represents the period of investment that we've had in conservation and land acquisition, and what the current landscape looks like, and then came up with an alternative vision of Minnesota, sort of what Minnesota may have looked like if we hadn't made those investment strategies, and then looked at the difference between those two versions of the Minnesota landscape and saw how those two different alternative strategies led to changes in environmental benefits, water quality, carbon sequestration, and those sort of things. So in addition to this study in which I said we found a positive return on investment in many of the parcels that DNR had acquired, we also have done several other studies looking at the similar kinds of questions. Some of them were mentioned in the previous talk. So we looked at a retrospective view of Minnesota going back, if we had made different decisions in the past, where we would be now in terms of the relative amounts of emphasizing agricultural production, development, or more forestry, and looked at the change in the flow of benefits from those different allocation strategies. We've also looked prospectively out to the year 2050 using the case study of legacy fund amendments and basically looked at different allocation strategies for how we'd use legacy funds and how targeting those investments towards habitat conservation versus some trying to maximize these environmental benefits like water quality and carbon sequestration, timber production, how those different investment strategies would ultimately lead to different land use changes in the state and the flow of environmental benefits from those different landscapes. So I'm just going to review really quickly some of the main lessons that we've learned from taking this framework of linking actions to changes in the environment and changes in water quality and impacts of those changes on people, particularly impacts on Minnesotans. So the first lesson is basically that land use change has a big impact on the kinds of benefits we receive from our landscapes, not just the habitat of the landscape, but also the impacts on human well-being, impacts on our economic activity, our recreational activity, our health. And other costs incurred by managing the environment. So it's clear that there's a link between land use change, water quality, and human well-being. That these benefits we receive from our landscape have real economic value. So in addition to looking at the market goods and services that we derive from our landscape, so the timber that's produced, the agricultural production, and development values, we also looked at values to human health, the values to our recreational activities, aesthetic values of the landscape, all the other aspects that that people perceive, how they perceive their environment, and looked at using non-market valuation techniques to value some of those changes. And that basically, using those techniques, we came up with this strong evidence for positive return on investment in conservation, or that conservation was in general a good investment in terms of increasing the overall well-being of people in Minnesota. We also learned that spatial targeting of conservation or restoration can have a big increase in net benefits. So another way of saying this is that it actually matters where you do conservation on the landscape. So if you're looking at improving water quality, for example, if you're doing a wetland restoration program, by understanding where you put those wetlands and how they fit into the other surrounding matrix of the landscape, you can get a lot more benefit for that individual investment. And now, thanks to a lot of research and mapping projects, we actually know a lot more about how to spatially target restoration, conservation, as well as balancing other sort of development needs and production of food and fiber on the landscape. So that we've come a long way in informing how we make decisions across the Minnesota landscape that will increase the net benefits we can expect from investment in conservation. We also know now that clearly identifying which benefits we're desiring by making those investments can change our land management and resource allocation strategies. So, for example, if you're interested in improving groundwater quality and reducing nitrate contamination of groundwater, we have a better idea of where to target those investments in the state. And you might actually target those conservation investments or management changes in different areas of the state than, let's say, if you wanted to try and increase lake clarity for recreational purposes. Or if you want to reduce loads to the Mississippi River that ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. So there are a variety of different water quality related goals that you may have in trying to increase either health or recreational activities or groundwater contamination. And so we're starting to understand how you might manage the landscapes differently depending on the benefits that you're trying to receive from those investments. So we've come a long way in identifying those. And I think the other main point is that the studies that we've done have basically shown that without really sacrificing a lot of economic gain in the state, we could probably increase net benefits to the environment and to society by just using our resources a little bit more efficiently. So there's some studies that we've done that illustrate sort of alternative ways in which we could manage our land resources and how that could lead to greater environmental benefits as well as net economic gain to the landscape. And that's all I have, and I'm happy to take questions.
And one final speaker, Dr. Nick Jordan, and then we'll get to questions. I was sort of intrigued by the last comment of Dr. Keeler. I'd love to know what some of those alternatives are. That's the slide we didn't quite get to yet. So, pardon me. Welcome
to
the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning. I'm Nick Jordan. I'm a professor of agronomy and plant genetics at the St. Paul campus of the U of M. And I would like to speak this morning in response to what John Foley would have pointed out to us about agriculture, which is that the challenge is to really substantially increase the total productivity of agriculture in the coming decades while also taking good care of our resources of land and soil and water. And there are some emerging opportunities to do exactly that, and this is what I would like to highlight in my time with you this morning. And so this is what we're referring to by the idea of win-win innovations. So we have a tremendously efficient and productive agriculture in Minnesota at the moment, but there are ways in which it could be even more so. And the fundamental strategy that we think can organize and drive a lot of the change that we need is to add several different kinds of crop plants to our current agriculture, which is dominated by summer annual crops, in other words, things like corn and soybeans that are grown during the summertime. And we feel that this shift in the way that we farm, this fundamental shift in the way that we farm, could, on the one hand, provide a lot of new economic opportunities for farmers and landowners in rural communities, and then provide a great deal of benefit for the rest of the state of Minnesota. To give you a sense of what we're sort of talking about here, the illustration on this slide is a visualization of a landscape in central Iowa that shows this mix of perennial crops and winter annual crops being added to a typical Iowa landscape dominated by corn and soybeans at the moment. So I want to say a little bit about the two sort of ingredients of this new agriculture. First of all, perennial crops. Perennial crops are very interesting organisms because they have a longer growing season, they have deeper root systems, they operate very differently than summer annual crops. And the important news about perennial crops, as the slide says, is that really big gains in productivity and efficiency can come from adding relatively small areas of perennial crops to our current rural landscapes. And the sort of diagram there on the left-hand side of the slide reminds me of a guitar pick, but it's a diagram of a small agricultural watershed in a study in Iowa. And there's a photograph from one of these experimental watersheds on this slide as well. And what you can see is that there's a strip of perennial vegetation that is running across a hillside there and alternating, most of the field, as you can see, is occupied by an annual crop corn, but about 10% of the area is occupied by this perennial vegetation. And as you can see, really dramatic changes in the way in which that small watershed holds on to water and nutrients result from that. So these perennial crops have powerful effects on the way that agricultural landscapes perform. To say a bit more about these so-called winter annual crops, they don't grow during the winter, but they do survive the winter in Minnesota. And they grow during periods in fall and spring when the summer annual crops are not growing. And they can add really substantial amounts of efficiency and productivity to our landscapes. This is a photograph of an emerging crop called field pennycress. It's in the mustard family. We're working on it in the agronomy department at the U of M. And it's very interesting because it can be established after soybean is harvested, and it provides a cover for soil over the winter, which can reduce soil erosion and runoff. It flowers early in the spring when there tends to be very little for our endangered bee populations to feed upon. It provides a dense ground cover which shades out weeds quite effectively, reducing the costs of weed control to farmers, which can be considerable costs. And best of all, it yields a lot of oil and feed. Our recent trials at the U have shown that we can move the effective yield of the pennycress soybean system up to about 72 bushels per acre. The current statewide average is in the low 40s. So that's a really major increase in the total productivity of these kinds of cropping systems. And what we think are rather conservative projections is that that could produce as much as $300 in additional profit for farmers and landowners who are growing soybeans. So these are interesting options. And essentially the message is that adding perennials and winter annuals to our landscapes does three things that are really of great value, we think. First of all, it has the ability to create value from underutilized resources. A good example of this is that, as Professor Forleason's presentation showed, we have to take increasingly good care and be increasingly careful of our water resources. Our current agriculture sends quite a bit of our annual rainfall out of the state. It exports it out of the state because of the drainage that's required to grow our summer annual crops. And that's a good thing from the point of view of growing those crops well. However, we're not using almost half of our annual rainfall to grow things. And these perennial and winter annual crops enable us to produce much value from that water and other resources. As well, these new crops, these perennials and winter annuals, have a lot of spin-off benefits. For example, I mentioned how the pennycress is capable of providing nectar and pollen for our endangered pollinators, our vitally important endangered pollinators. That's a good example of that. And then finally, these crops are, generally speaking, able to handle climate variability quite a bit more than summer annuals. So in that sense, we can insure against climate variability and events such as the drought that we've just experienced. To give you a sense of the potential, I want to tell you briefly about an analysis by our colleague Bruce Dale at Michigan State University. The scenario that he explored was a shifting of agricultural land use in the core 250 million acres that we use currently for export agriculture in the U.S. And in that agriculture, we currently use about 25% of those 250 million acres for perennial crops of various sorts. If we were to shift that land use from 25 up to 45%, 20% increase, then really quite dramatic increases in the total productivity of our agriculture would result. First of all, we would not be growing less of our summer annual, our vitally important summer annual crops. We would be producing much more biofuel, potentially about 80% of the gasoline that we produce from imported petroleum. We would gain lots of spin-off benefits in terms of soil, water, and wildlife. And we would also, I don't know how I left it off the slide, but we would also reduce total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by about 10%. So that's a big bundle of benefits we would submit for a relatively small land use change. Finally, I'd like to speak very briefly about how do we get there from here. And essentially, there are very interesting emerging technologies. You see in this diagram something called APEX, which is an emerging technique for adding considerable value to currently low-value biomass feedstocks, things like corn stalks, by increasing the availability of the sugars in those materials, which then makes them useful directly as a high-quality animal feed. You'll see that there's an arrow flowing from this this biomass processing depot there to ruminant animals. They also are high-value feedstock for bioenergy production. And this AFEX process, we think, is very well suited for locally owned, for example, by farmer cooperatives like our ethanol plants, facilities that would add value to these materials from perennial cropping systems and enable that value to be captured in rural communities. And this is the sort of comprehensive approach to creating these economic opportunities, or in fact seizing these economic opportunities that we think are important to realize the possibilities in this new approach to agriculture. So thank you very much, and we look forward to our discussion.
And so, Dr. Jordan, in a sense, the previous speakers, starting with Dr. Seeley, talked about climate changes. We heard some of the challenges, but we're concluding with that this changing climate also provides new opportunity, ways that perhaps we would have not worked in Minnesota before, and that we take advantage. So with challenges come opportunity.
Yes, that's right.
I think we're ready to go into questions, unless Dr. Thorleifson, do you have any concluding comments? Then Representative Carlson, question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and my questions of Dr. Jordan. How closely do you work with the university extension agents in getting this information out into the agricultural community? Maybe not you personally, but your department or others that have testified.
Well, we are certainly in close partnership with our extension colleagues. You bet.
And the other follow-up Madam Chair, they used to be county extension agents, and now it's a regional, but they have to develop their long-range plan in each one of those regions in terms of what they're going to emphasize. And is that being done, to your knowledge? What some of the things you're talking about, are they included in those long-range plans?
Well, they Dr. certainly Jordan. Are in certain parts of the state. Yeah, I can speak from experience with the folks who are involved. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a question for Dr. Seeley, if he could come back to the dais. Doctor, thank you for your presentation.
Members, I don't know if there are a couple of extra chairs there, if it's possible to find five chairs and we would just have everybody come to the front, it might facilitate rather than switching. If there's probably a page chair there, too, if we needed to use it. Dr. Seeley.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Again, Dr. Seeley, thanks for your presentation. Your numbers indicate something may be happening. But I just have to ask you, you say your records go back about 150 years, and some would say that's kind of a snippet in time compared to the number of years that the Earth has been around and ice ages, things like that. How would you answer that question about is this a long enough time period to really make the judgments that some people are making about climate change?
Dr. Seeley.
Very good question. The judgments we're making about climate change and its consequences are in the context of where we are now in terms of the structures of our society, our quality of life, the things we count on. We can find evidence in paleo records, that is, records that predate our instrumental records, that the behavior of the climate system over this part of the North American landscape has been drastically different. Extremes have been even more so, and periods of, I mean, we can go back in time and find evidence for all kinds of behaviors that are outside the realm of what our instruments show. But the fact of the matter is that as we've evolved here since the state was settled, the behavior of our climate we've measured, and we've taken great care in documenting and quality controlling those records and going back and correcting small issues of time of observation and exposure of the instruments and a whole variety of other things. We've taken great care there for the quality and integrity of our records. And the behaviors we are seeing in these records in the last two or three decades, as I said earlier, are outside the realm of what we have measured historically. And the pace of change in our measurements is outside the realm of what we have measured historically. I think what's more important for us is temporal context. What we have to cope with, what we have to adjust to, is a pace of change more rapid than our predecessors had to cope with in this state. And in fact, it's having impacts on our infrastructure. So if we want to continue to live in a manner that we have grown accustomed and we want generations that follow us to have the same opportunities and enjoy the same environment, we absolutely have to acknowledge this and make adjustments for it. So I think that's the more important question that I'm trying to address when I talk to people as yourselves, because we do need to understand what's going on and how it's affecting our people, and it's how it's affecting our resources.
Follow-up, Representative Anderson?
No, thank you.
I have Con Mahoney, Earl McDonald. Representative Con.
Yes. Madam Chairman, and I think maybe to all of the speakers, you all kind of talked about the need for information, but I never heard you mention one of the things which I've always thought has been the best state repository of information, and that's the MnGeo system. And is all of this information, what used to be called LIMIC, and it's now, I think it's called MnGeo, it may have changed again, but and one of the things I'm interested in, there's issues like water resources and water depth and changes go into that system also, and it's all our, do people use that in your research, and are we keeping up to date on getting information into that system?
And there might be several responses to that. I'd just invite anyone to respond who might. Dr. Thorleston?
Well, I can respond briefly. I agree it's an important point, Representative Kahn, in terms of coordination and efficiency, and we certainly do work with the systems you referred to, and really we're taking advantage of technology to make our information more and more accessible, not only through those mechanisms, but of course, most importantly, getting that information out to users such as landowners and county staff. So yes, we do work with those arrangements.
I would add that in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate, we too work with those. We make great use watershed by watershed in terms of the flow measurements, many of which on our watersheds go back several decades, the flow volume measurements. We also make use of the digitized soil surveys, and of course we now make use in a gridded manner to our state climate database, where we not only take the individual site locations, but we grid them so that we have more even spatial description of what's going on in the state. And all of that is encompassed in this overall data management system that's evolved over our lifetime.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, the reason I brought that point up is that I'm very interested in making sure that any time that we give grants that have to do with land management or land acquisition and so forth, that we are dependent on having the transparency and also having the information available to everyone about how we're doing that. And I have one additional question for Dr. Seely. And that was the your issue on the heavy precipitation trend and the percentage of very wet days. How is this going to affect the groundwater in the state? Do you go down that far to get to see that?
The heavy precipitation is perhaps from the standpoint of what Peter refers to as extremes, it's garnered the most attention in recent years because its consequences have been rather devastating. We have had, I showed you 3 1,000-year floods using current statistics. Now, I don't know if the statistical approaches with the new manual will change, but still we're talking about unprecedented frequencies of very heavy events. Many of those, though, problematically translate into issues related to runoff, not groundwater. We have our watershed discharge has been remarkable. For example, this year on the St. Louis River in Carlton County, the storm of June that devastated that area of the state produced the all-time highest volumetric discharge on the St. Louis River. And yet, as we migrated deeper into this year of widespread drought in Minnesota, where we had 55 counties declared for federal drought disaster, we find that the volumetric flow on the St. Louis River in October was one of the lowest of all time. So here in 1 year's time, we capture the extreme volumetric measurements for one of our watersheds. And so it translates more problematically, I think, Representative Kahn, into this problem with surface discharge than it does groundwater. Maybe Harvey has a more pertinent comment to groundwater.
What I was asking is it doing anything good for groundwater, which is a problem? And is there any way to make it do anything good for groundwater?
Well, to add to what Professor Seeley has said, I agree it's an important question. And if a given amount of precipitation more preferentially occurs as extreme precipitation events, that amount of precipitation will not be as beneficial to groundwater levels due to a greater amount being lost to surface runoff.
But I think the answer then, I'll stop there. The answer then is, how can we change that surface runoff to be something beneficial to something we're also having a problem with, groundwater?
And on that point, Representative Kahn, keeping water on the land, slowing the drainage, is beneficial to groundwater recharge. And so if in any circumstances, and in particular in the case of more extreme precipitation events, holding water on the land is beneficial to groundwater recharge, which is so crucial to sustaining our groundwater pumping.
And that's definitely what we heard during that period of time when we were looking at the Red River Valley. How do you keep the water on the land during those times? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually a question for Dr. Jordan. You speak to the ag part of changing how we actually farm, going from primarily summer crops to a two-season type of crop, one using perennials and one using our typical corn, soybean, and feedstock. In your research, have you put a dollar figure on the cost of changing a farm from summer crop to two-season crops, such as a 300-acre farm, a 3,000-acre farm, and then the follow-up with that is the rest of the infrastructure that would be needed to take advantage of a two-season crop system?
Dr. Jordan.
Well, thank you for that good question. We are in the process of trying to cost out, essentially, that transition that you speak of. And, in fact, the slide that is still on the screen there illustrates the sort of infrastructure that would be needed to add these perennial and winter annual crops to our landscape. I do want to emphasize that we are absolutely not talking about replacing the summer annual crops. We are talking about adding additional crops to that landscape. And the transition costs, broadly speaking, appear to be affordable. An example of that would be if we were to think about a scenario where we're adding that winter oilseed crop of pennycress to soybean. So there are some additional costs that are involved in that, such as sowing the crop and so on. But if we sit down and consider the whole picture, including the reduction in weed control costs, and especially the high value of what would be produced, it projects out to be a net profit of about $300 per acre. And the and without requiring any major changes in how a person would go about their farming operation. So we think that your question about transition costs is a very important one, but we think, broadly speaking, they're affordable.
And you said that was $300 extra profit.
Indeed, in profit, not just revenue, but profit.
Follow-up?
So do you have an idea of when that further study or that fleshing out of cost would be available? I don't disagree that this is a good idea. It's a business opportunity for Greater Minnesota, and I see all the potential. But if it is an upfront cost of $500 or $50,000 for a 3,000-acre farm, that's not altogether hard to overcome. But if it is in the millions of dollars for the state and the state agricultural industry, then it's a different story. So, and it shades how we proceed. So I'd be interested in knowing if that's a study that's coming out this year or next year or 10 years down the road.
Dr. Jordan.
Thank you. Additional good questions. We have active research programs underway that are measuring these costs. There are indications from previous work, again, that these costs are manageable. And I think an important point here is that these transition costs should not be borne by farmers and landowners alone. That if we were to make this shift to perennials and winter annual crops in selected parts of our landscapes, there would be many beneficiaries. And those many beneficiaries should share in the costs. There's a farm bill program, a federal farm bill program called the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, BCAP, which provides excellent cost sharing for these transition costs. That cost sharing is awarded on a competitive basis to places where there's a sufficient number of, there's sufficient acreage essentially converting over to produce biomass crops. And so that's a good example of that sort of, a concrete example of that sort of cost sharing. But we are actively trying to price this out, and we think we'll have some results in 3 or 4 years.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know which of you would answer this, but how would climate change, how do you anticipate it influencing population trends in greater Minnesota?
Population trends in greater Minnesota. It's a whole new direction. None of our speakers will...
None of us seem to want to answer this because it's right. A very challenging question because it depends on how climate change influences things such as agriculture and forestry and the vitality of local communities, which requires understanding not only natural science and agricultural science, but social science and economics. And so I think the short answer is none of us really know the answer to that question. But that doesn't mean it's not a great question. It means we need to put our thinking caps on to figure out what this all means for the future of our small communities scattered throughout the state.
And maybe a different discipline in the academic world, too. Follow up? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is for Peter Reich. In your testimony regarding the challenges facing our Minnesota forest, you mentioned that in regards to climate change, we really don't know what changes we'll have on our forest. And then you also said there's great uncertainty, so we really don't, we're not aware of what changes will happen. And there's an uncertainty in how we manage those. So if we don't really know what climate change will have on our forest, and we're uncertain exactly what to do to our forest, is it possible that in an attempt to so-called halt climate change in our forest, we will alter our forest in a way that will have dire consequences? Short of stopping the forest fragmentation, parcelization, which we need because of our growing population. As another slide indicates that our food production is up 3 times. So I wonder what recommendations you are giving us or have in your lieu of your testimony.
Dr. Rice.
Thanks for the question. There are kind of 2 parts to that. I'll answer, focus on the first one about uncertainty. We shouldn't confuse uncertainty about the magnitude of change with uncertainty about the direction of change. There's no doubt among the scientific community that it is getting warmer. And so as greenhouse gas emissions continue, as concentrations continue to rise, there's little doubt that the planet will warm. What's uncertain is how fast. What's also uncertain is how dry or wet it will be in Minnesota and how fast we'll switch back and forth from that in any given week, month, year, or decade. And so I think there's no doubt that at the southern fringe of the boreal forest, which is where the forests in northern Minnesota are, that those forests are likely to face enormous challenges to their sustained productivity because of climate change. And so if we didn't know whether it was going to get hotter or colder, then yes, making any kind of climate-related modification of our management might be unwise because we'd really be totally guessing. But since we know the direction, I think it's more a question of how do we take the information we have and try to modify our behavior in a timely way to try to get out in front of the change so that we don't face a forest that in 20 years or 40 years or 60 years all of a sudden is falling apart in front of us and we haven't anticipated that and tried to manage for a forest that would be healthy in that time frame.
Representative Falk.
Madam Chairman.
Sorry, follow-up?
Follow-up, thank you.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the science of that, Mr. Reich, but when you say in your testimony that there's uncertainty, we really don't know what climate change will have to our forest, how can you say it could decline right before our eyes? You're contradicting yourself. When on one side you're saying we don't know what the changes are, it's too uncertain, and yet we possibly could see a decline right before our eyes. So I'm perplexed in your testimony, and because you're a professor, I find that you're probably very an expert in your field, and being just a photographer, I want to educate myself. But when you contradict yourself, it leaves me perplexed. Can you please explain?
Yes, thank you for the follow-up question. I'll try to give an example that helps clarify that. If you smoke or I smoke, there's actually no predictive information there about whether I'm likely to get cancer. Because there's great uncertainty about whether smoking influences the health of any individual person. Yet we can predict that for the population as a whole, a lot more people get cancer. So it's that kind of uncertainty. There's uncertainty about whether a given patch of forest will be influenced and how it will be influenced, but that doesn't mean we can't predict with some degree of confidence the overall direction in which the forest will go in the future, given that we know the overall direction of climate, and we know the overall direction of the response to those kinds of climate shifts. Now, it doesn't mean that we know for certain that the forest will fall apart or when they'll fall apart, but that's the best guess we can make at the moment.
Were you finished?
Well, follow up, if I may.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Well, that's I think it's wise that we predict what could happen, but I would just caution you that in our predictions, since we don't know really what climate change will have to our forests and there's uncertainty, that we approach it with kid gloves. Wouldn't you agree, Professor?
Yes, I certainly agree with that, that we should be very careful about what we do, and that we should not just storm forward and make changes without thinking them through in great detail.
So he's warning about unintended consequences, I think. Representative Falk. I have Falk, Norton, Purcell, Hanson, Benson. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is a question preferably to Dr. Thorleifson, but if somebody else wants to take stab at it as well. One of the things that I worry about, or I've seen a preponderance of a lot of efforts to remove water from the land quickly, specifically in ag areas, we've seen a lot of tiling, and we see a lot of irrigation being put above that same tiling. And I'm just wondering if we are removing a lot of water from a particular system, and then we've seen the issues with drought, do we have any data or good tools to predict when we kind of hit a point where we've removed enough water from a particular system that it really becomes harmful, and then we're going to have to go and adjust maybe the practices, or do we have any of those trigger points identified? If you could try to comment to that.
Dr. Thorleifson and anyone else who might.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And there are trigger points, such as if your well dries up, that's a trigger point, or if a wetland goes dry. So there certainly are trigger points out there. But broadly, I think you've well summarized a broad range of issues where we as a society have objectives. We want to optimize agricultural production. We want to manage the landscape around us. We want to avoid flooding. And so, yes, drainage has many benefits. Yes, drainage can reduce groundwater recharge. So I think what we are all working together to do is to assemble the information, identify the options such that we can progressively make better informed, wiser decisions on enjoying the benefits of drainage where that is what we pursue, and at the same time seize the opportunities to encourage groundwater recharge, which is essential, such that our pumping can be sustained where those opportunities present themselves, and such that the net benefit is in favor of groundwater recharge. We want to take advantage of those opportunities. So clearly, to sum up, better information, better identification of options, better assessment of cost-benefit will allow us to drain where it's beneficial and to retain water to encourage groundwater recharge where that's the net benefit.
Rips up, Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. I guess do we have any idea of when we may hit like that perfect storm point where we're removing water so rapidly, we're withdrawing more from the aquifers, and we don't know when it's how quickly it's being recharged? Do we see kind of that confluence of events, or and how long do we have any idea to predict that we have? Is it years, decades, centuries to continue in a particular path, or do we just have no idea what scope of time we're dealing with as to how quickly we're withdrawing water from aquifers and how quickly we're replenishing it?
Dr. Solis.
I think the answer is there isn't a perfect storm, and there won't be a point at which the system as a whole has reached that critical point. What we are seeing are groundwater levels declining in some areas. Clearly, if you live on White Bear Lake, from your perspective, you've reached the critical point. And so what we are all striving to do is to identify sustainable pumping levels, and at the same time recognize that even if you have achieved what you thought was a sustainable pumping level, and for example stable groundwater levels, progressively we recognize the impact of pumping on groundwater discharge to springs. And so my response is that there isn't that clear turning point unless it's your well or your lake that has been impacted. And what we're seeing instead are broad effects that in some cases are deleterious, and a recognition that that we need to better plan our pumping. As our population increases, as our use of water increases, we need to plan for the long term on the basis of much better understanding of the groundwater systems based on mapping and monitoring and modeling, as I stressed. And so I think, again, the response to the question is that the effects are broad and diffuse, and whether the crisis is today or 30 years from now is greatly variable.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is perhaps a little different type of question. I have two, and I think one might be a little tongue-in-cheek, so bear with me. First, I want to thank you for being here. This has been very informative, and one of my goals, and I've never served on these particular committees that are here, so this is fascinating and new information for me, but as a legislator, it's my hope that we can do a better job of using research, and particularly our assets here at the university, and thank you for each of your perspectives here, that we can use it in forming our policy in a better way. So maybe my tongue-in-cheek question is this. Are there other University of Minnesota researchers who are not here today who would come in and tell us that what your presentations are inaccurate or wrong?
Okay, I'm going to take that one.
No, it is a serious question, but...
Dr. Seeley.
Thank you for that question. I chair the College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resource Sciences, which some of you know as the St. Paul Campus Civic Engagement Committee. We that work for you as public servants at your land-grant university take our citizenship very seriously. And speaking for the committee and in turn for the faculty of this group, I can emphatically say that we would all relish an opportunity to enhance your knowledge base on any decisions that you make as a legislator, and we also argue among ourselves. So to be quite honest, you might find some disparity in opinion if you had a different group of five or six come before you. But it would probably be over the, shall we say, uncertain knowledge. We have both knowledge of high certainty and knowledge of uncertainty. We're exploring everything that we see that is important to our scientific disciplines, and we try to translate that into something that is applicable to the state of Minnesota where we live, because we relish our home just as you do. So I would say that you would find cooperation if you invited any member of our faculty to come before your committee or visit with you individually.
I have Purcell, Hansen, Benson, Clark, and Swadzinski,
We are going to run over just a little bit because I would like to get to your questions, but very, very briefly. Representative Norton.
Thank you. So the second part, which isn't tongue-in-cheek, had to do with Dr. Keeler and Dr. Jordan's presentations. I think there's maybe I understood those a little better than some of the others. What else are you doing besides coming to talk to us today, which is great? What other venues are you using to help take this research out into the community? And I heard DNR mentioned and Extension. Are those the primary sources? Are there other things that you do to help move this so that the politicians don't sit and argue about whether something is real or not real, but as you develop and find these this research, how do you get it out so change is made outside of the legislative process?
Well, I'll speak briefly
Dr.
to that. We are committed to working very, very hard on commercialization and enterprise development. One of the weaknesses, I think, of agricultural research has been that the land-grant colleges of agriculture have identified new things that could be grown in a state, but have not worked on the absolutely crucial issue of how do farmers and landowners may add to their livelihood from growing those new crops. So we work very hard on that commercialization and enterprise development aspect of it, and are attempting to develop a model that could be used throughout the Midwest to take that more seriously. It's been it's a crucial issue. So that would be our principal vehicle, rather than attempting any sort of putting the information out there and assuming folks will do something with it.
And I hear Representative Norton as encouraging that.
Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity. I'll just comment on a couple of things. So I've been part of a variety of workshops that we've had at the University of Minnesota where we brought in people from DNR, from MPCA, from some of the lead environmental NGOs in the state, as well as other decision makers, and talked about particular issues such as, well, how do we manage water resources? How do we put values on water quality for Minnesota? And so key, trying to network with some of those key individuals to get the message and the research we're doing out. I will say there's lots of room for improvement in general with academia and trying to get our word out. We're very good at communicating to other scientists, but not as good necessarily with the general public. But our lab has talked with reporters from the Star Tribune about some of the work that we're doing. I gave a talk at DNR a month ago in part of their science engagement series. So I think we're working on it, but there's room for improvement.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to offer my thanks to you, too, and the positive approach on this, what you said earlier about challenges as opportunities. I think that's a good takeaway message here. I think this would be, I believe, for Dr. Seeley, but you take it as you wish. I, as a user of peer-reviewed journals, I was listening as you answered Representative Anderson's question about paleo information, and it seems to me, and some of my readings going back in mercury research and glacial cores, that there's CO2 information that informs us in this cycle that we're in, particularly with carbon dioxide. I just wondered if you'd speak a little bit to that, if you would.
Dr. Seeley.
Thank you for the question. I will frankly admit that I'm not a paleoclimatologist. I'm a traditionally trained climate scientist in the measurement and application of those measurements. But my knowledge of paleoclimate does confirm that in the context of the last 800,000 or 900,000 years, the observation of the Earth climate system now with respect to carbon dioxide is clearly on the extreme end of that. We are heading, now we can go back 550 million years, and there is evidence to suggest once upon a time the planet Earth had an atmosphere with about 3,000 parts per million carbon dioxide. But nevertheless, in the context of the paleo information, what's been dissected from ice cores and other avenues, we are in a period of aberration, we are in a period of extreme, and that extreme is playing out as consequences on the Earth climate system. The recent papers, one notably by Ben Santer from Lawrence Livermore in the National Academy of Science proceedings this last year, emphasized, based on a signal-to-noise ratio study, that the human fingerprint
and its influence on atmospheric composition, changing atmospheric composition, is all over this change we're measuring. The other thing to bear in mind is that the change we're measuring in the Earth climate system has great disparity. It is an oversimplification of the science to think that climate change is going on at some uniform rate across the landscape of planet Earth. It is not. It is going on at different rates in different places, but it is tied to this paleo evidence that you bring up.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Seeley, and precipitation variability with the soils that we have in Minnesota and the range of the traditional range of precipitation from drier to wetter, and maybe this is a soils question more than a climate question, but does precipitation affect the productivity of our soils and the impact of the soils? For example, if we have high pHs, low pHs, higher organic matter, if we're going to be seeing changes of 2 to 3 inches of precipitation on an average, what does that do to our soils over the long run and their productivity?
Is that a Dr. Seeley question?
I will. Thank you, Representative Hausman. I'll try to answer that as best I can. I've worked with soil scientists for 35 years at the university, and so the way I would translate that is we have to remember the available soil moisture in the soil is the primary plant nutrient. Plants don't grow without it. Above and beyond pH or mineral nutrition or whatever, microorganisms, we absolutely have to have the presence of water vapor in the pore space of the soil. And in turn, liquid water that is root extractable. Yes, there's going to be implications for all this. We might mitigate this with tile drainage in eras where we're too wet. Now, in our modern technology, we're actually looking at the mitigation of controlled tile drainage, so we can control the volume of stored moisture in the soil by controlling the level of drainage in that soil. So, yes, these changes that are appreciable in precipitation quantity, and I might add precipitation timing, and I might add precipitation character, whether it's intense rain or light rain, all have implications for the potential to raise our level of production. It's going to play out in a variety of ways. Unfortunately, our soil moisture measurements, since you brought up the issue of soil moisture, we do have measurement histories in this state, and as we come into the growing season of 2013, many of our soil moisture measurements as a carryover effect of 2012 are at the lowest levels we have ever measured. And so this is going to be very problematic. We are going to be highly dependent on spring rainfall for the coming 2013 growing season.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'd just like to take our discussion that Representative Anderson, Norton, Purcell began and take it to the next step. And you know, as I look at this issue and listen to the scientific community present their findings, which is almost universal now, I accept them. But we're in a political society here, and the political ramifications of which direction we go are very, very profound, because if one sees this as simply an aberration, it allows one then to kind of move on with what we're doing. And humankind, it seems to me, does not like change. Also philosophical and even theological aspects to all this. The political ones, for example, if we move in the direction I think that the science community is suggesting we ought to do, it has profound effects on individual rights, the role of government, all those philosophical issues. I don't have an answer as to how to convince my colleagues who see this more as kind of an aberration or something that just happens because this is the way world events in the natural world occur. I'm not sure this is a question for our scientists here today, but I'd be curious if they have any suggestion as how we can move this discussion towards making political decisions based on science, rather than philosophical arguments about the role of government, how large it is, or even theological questions about whether this is simply something that is to happen and that we all must somehow accept it. I'm not sure either any of the scientists would like to answer. But we're dealing with a political issue as well.
Civic discourse, you've just heard a response to the questions we've had. We're going to have, I think we don't have anyone else coming in, but Representative Clark is the last.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just put that question on the table. Basically, I appreciate this presentation so much. I was a little surprised, though, in looking at key issues, that one that's really out there a lot these days, and I think it was maybe insinuated a little bit in issues where Ms. Keeler was talking about contaminants and water energy excess and so on. But one of the things that's certainly facing policymakers here is the whole issue of fracking and the relation of fracking to water contamination, both deep water and fresh water. And I know there's no time to answer that, but I'd just like to put it out there. Maybe sometime in the future we can have some discussion about that, because both actual fracking and the use of Minnesota sands and so on that are related to that are, I think, we have a lot of questions about contamination of water, and I just didn't hear that come up in any way, so I wanted to just put that out there.
So those last two were comments. I think we'll give an opportunity for a closing statement for anyone, if some concluding thought, if anyone has one.
Well, I just want to again say that we appreciate this opportunity. It's our role to assist everyone in society. We scientists are very good at jumping past what we know and focusing on what we don't know. But I think we're all scientists in our own way. We all have knowledge that's relevant. And I think we're all in this together, working hard to make the right decisions. And I think that's what you asked us for. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate the opportunity.
It was, the complete picture was very, very helpful. We thank you very much for your time. And members for your attention. Meeting is adjourned.